This is Frankly MSP, where managed service providers get real.
Hey, and welcome to episode 8 of Frankly MSP, the podcast for managed service providers who want to boost their productivity, efficiency, and profitability. I'm your host, Jennifer Tribe. Well, we're soon heading into the holiday season, and I hope you find at least a few days to relax, spend time with family, recharge, and maybe you'll also have some time to think back on the year just passed and give some thought to the year ahead. What are you hoping to accomplish? I'm not necessarily talking about resolutions, because studies show that those fail for most people most of the time, but it's good to think about what you want to focus on in the coming year. There's a great exercise that I learned from blogger Chris Brogan. I don't know if he originated it, but I picked it up from him. And what he did each year was choose 3 focus words, single words, just 3. And these serve as your touchstones throughout the year. So you can, you know, put them up by your desk or put them on the home screen of your phone or whatever it is that helps you think about them throughout the year. So if you're not sure about a decision or maybe you feel like you're getting distracted, you go back to your focus words. Let's say one of your words was commitment. You'd ask yourself, am I honoring commitment the way I want to in this situation right now? Do you have focus words for 2018? Or goals for yourself or your business? I'd love to hear what they are. Drop by the show notes at ovic.com/franklymsp/008 and let us know. And if one of your goals happens to be around increasing efficiency or building value in your MSP in 2018, you're going to love today's interview. My guest is Nigel Moore. Nigel has an MSP training and consulting company called My Technology Business. But before that, he owned an MSP, and he has a fantastic story about how he used SOPs, standard operating procedures, to move his team and his client service from good to great, and ultimately how he sold that business on some pretty nice terms because of those SOPs. So that's coming up later in the show, but right now let's take a look at what's going on. Richard Tubb and Carl Palachuk join us to discuss the latest news through an MSP lens.
You're listening to Frankly MSP, brought to you by Ovic Networks.
Hey everyone, Richard Tubb here with another episode of What's Going On. And I'm at home here in Newcastle upon Tyne in the northeast of the UK. I'm joined today by Carl Palachuk. And we were talking just before you came on air about a specific story that's caught your eye. It's by the New York Times, and it's about melting Arctic ice makes high-speed internet a reality in a remote town, but not just any remote town. Perhaps you could pick up why this was so interesting to you.
It's a ridiculously remote town. Point Hope, Alaska is just about 700 miles away from Anchorage, but you have to take 2 little planes to get there. So it's a very, very isolated town. And they only have about 700 residents, but they're getting super high-speed internet because the melting ice caps have allowed the big ships to go through and drop fiber. And they actually are burying fiber at the bottom of the ocean over the Arctic. And that way they're able to connect Europe on one hand and Asia on the other. And so this town is just in a very happy, lucky place to be as those connections get made. It's quite amazing because your response to me was not everybody in the UK has that kind of internet.
Well, I was going to say, I'm here in the northeast of the UK, and this specific estate that I live on, which is sort of semi-rural, we don't even have, you know, cable modem. We don't have high-speed broadband here. Yet you're telling me that Point Hope in Alaska, one of the most remote towns in the United States, and I understand it's 3,700 miles away from New York, they're getting high-speed broadband?
Yes. Once it touches land, then they can connect all of those little rural places up in the middle of nowhere, Alaska. It's quite amazing. The big picture is, you know, they're not doing this for 700 people in Alaska. They're doing this because of connecting Europe and Asia. And one of the things they talk about in this New York Times article is that milliseconds can make a difference in terms of millions of dollars when you're trading, you know, stocks on the stock exchange. And so it's certainly worth the $700 million cost
Wow.
that they're putting into it.
Well, it's set by a company, the New York Times article says it's by a company called Quintillion, and it's a five-year-old-based company based in Anchorage, which, as you said, is about 700 miles away from this place.
Right.
And as you say, it's to build a faster digital link between London and Tokyo. But I think the real story here is how many MSPs listening to this are going to have the same reaction that I had, which is, holy cow, there's high-speed broadband in Alaska, and yet I've got a client down the road who can't get more than, say, 2 meg. What's it all about?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, this year I went to both England and Australia, and the rural areas have the same issues absolutely everywhere. Rural US, you know, like my friend in Albuquerque, they literally just got fiber connections this year for a handful of businesses. But a lot of places, they can't get anything. In Australia, they have this huge nationwide move to do national broadband, but it's going to take years and years and years, and they're not going to be able to do everything they've promised. And in the meantime, these guys up in Alaska are getting 200 gigabits per second.
So this is not without precedent. I think I've shared with you, Carl, I'm actually an e-resident of Estonia. And people ask me, why are you an e-resident of Estonia? Well, it's the most digitally advanced country in the world, and they've heavily invested in broadband and things. So is this the start of a trend? Are we going to see more of these countries or places that, frankly, we've never heard of before, you know, suddenly becoming cyber hubs?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's also interesting that a whole lot of infrastructure in terms of being able to sell services to these people is now open, not just shirts and things off of Amazon, but if you wanted to start an IT business in Alaska, you could be busy for quite a while getting all of these people connected up to the new broadband.
Mm. So give me an insight into MSPs in the US. You said the issue you see worldwide is any rural location has problem with broadband. What do the clients, the MSPs that you work with in the US, do for those customers that they've got in rural locations who just can't get the high-speed broadband that they need?
I'm in a big county and you can get pretty much anything. But my last office, I only had one option, and it was really slow. It was cable internet, but it was like 10 meg. And across the river in the next county, there are places where you literally can't get anything except DSL. So you're at 1 meg, 2 megs. And so you do what you can. Sometimes clients are willing to move, but other times you just say, look, you put your stuff in the cloud and then you access it on the fastest line you can. At the conference in Australia, one of the IT providers there brought a 4G card, hooked it into a wireless hub, and provided internet for the entire conference over his phone, basically.
Yeah, yeah. I've definitely done that before. That's a really easy way to make friends and influence people at conferences. I actually create an SSID signal that's called Say Hello to Me at Tublog on Twitter. And then I get people throughout the day sort of popping in and saying, hey, YouTube blog, can I get onto your Wi-Fi? So, yeah, I think it's it. But in terms of rural broadband, is this still a massive issue for small businesses?
Yes, especially, again, in the most rural areas. For example, in the United States, it's not a lot different from the inside of Australia. If you're in an area like Wyoming, if you're not in a big town, you don't have very many choices. And in a lot of places, it's satellite, which is very unreliable, or it's dial-up. That is still the reality in a great deal of the U.S. And obviously, in much more rural places, in Africa and so forth, they're looking forward to Google putting these balloons up in the air so that they can get their internet.
Yeah, Project Loon, which they talk about, which is basically balloons flying, if I understand it correctly, is hitting the lower atmosphere and just being blown around by the hot air up there. And they've got a cable that connects them to the ground. Is that the way you understand it?
Yes, but they're also doing it over the ocean. So I don't know how they're anchoring buoys. And, you know, it's one of those things that nobody on earth has enough money to do it except Google.
Yes, indeed. So, and to just change tack a little bit, talking of Google and huge companies, an episode of What's Going On wouldn't be complete without us mentioning one of our favorite tools, and that's the Amazon Alexa. Of course, we have to whisper that, otherwise she hears us and starts talking to us during the episode. But of course, this week, CNBC have reported something that we've been driving at, perhaps you and I, for the past few episodes here, talking about the Amazon Alexa. And Amazon is getting ready to bring Alexa into the work environment. And Alexa for Business platform is planned with a suite of launch partners. And analysts are saying these new tools could help with getting connected into telephone conferences and bringing up business data. So suddenly this goes from being a consumer tool into something that Amazon are bringing into the business space. What do you make of it?
Well, I think it's interesting that the technology behind it must be incredibly sophisticated. If you think about, okay, here's an office, get me connected to a phone conference or a video conference. Well, there's a lot of options there. So is this just putting a voice front end onto a complex system, or is there something new going on here? They made it sound like they're developing tools specifically so that, you know, once Alexa has her hands into you, her hooks into you, you'll not be able to escape.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a big fan of Alexa. I use it at home here, obviously a consumer platform, but it connects into my British Gas Hive, my home automation for the central heating system. It connects into my Lightwave system for my home automation. So basically, I can say to Alexa, turn the lights on, raise the temperature. And as I understand it from this article from CNBC talking about the Amazon business platform, they're going to develop specific skills or apps for business customers. So with teleconferencing, adding data to enterprise-focused sales programs. We really are, if this article is to be believed, we're moving into almost like the Star Trek generation of, instead of us tapping away at a computer, or even tapping at a computer screen, we're just going to be telling the computer what we want it to do. Add these notes to the CRM package, you know, make a phone call to this customer or this prospect.
Well, I don't know if you use Siri, but you can ask your iPhone to say, oh, set me a timer for 30 minutes or something like that. And Alexa will do the same thing, right? But now you're talking about turn on these lights, turn off the lights in the warehouse, lock the doors, you know, stuff like that. And at some point, we need some certifications or something. We need some formal training. And that's what this announcement is about, is the beginning of that, you know, hack your office in a good way.
Yeah, training. Indeed. And of course, it brings up a whole different area of questions around security as well. So if you've got these open systems, I mean, Amazon are talking with Microsoft about working for Alexa and Cortana to work together. But it opens up this whole security issue, doesn't it? That if you've got these open APIs and, you know, anything can tie into it, the security has got to be a lot tighter than it is at the moment.
Just before we started this podcast in the summer, there was a story, I think it was in July, about a fish tank at a casino in Las Vegas that was hacked because they wanted to, you know, feed the fish and control the temperature and the lights and all that. But it was on an open system and somebody actually used it to tap into that network. So IoT is insecure by default. And that is literally, I mean, that's the Richard Tubb Full Employment Act right there. Right? So you'll be able to spend the next 10 years securing the Internet of Things.
We've had a lot of feedback over the last few episodes from people on Twitter and via email, interested in AI that we've been talking about, interested in the business application of these consumer technologies. But this isn't really coming to the forefront. So if you needed any more evidence that these consumer, I was going to say toys there, but these consumer gadgets are going to make their way into the business place, we are literally living in a world now where people are going to start talking to Alexa at work and barking out orders. So plenty of opportunities for MSPs there.
Yeah, and it will be interesting to see, how do we separate Alexa at work from Alexa at home? Yeah. Right? I mean, I have to log into my work voice activated account, not my home activated account, you know, so.
And of course, it opens up anything that the consumers need to do. Of course, these devices are pretty much put in place there, ideally with a long-term view for these companies, you know, Amazon and Apple and Microsoft and so forth, to allow you to really easily pay for stuff, to order stuff. And of course, that's going to be the same in an office environment. So instead of ordering, you know, soap powder or even a takeaway pizza, what's it going to look like in the office? The office manager no longer needs to be told, hey, we need to order a new ink cartridge or a new toner cartridge. Somebody's just going to shout out in the middle of the office, Alexa, order us a new toner cartridge, and it's just going to come, which opens up a whole kettle of fish there over how or who that order is going to be placed with. Who are Amazon going to put at the front of the queue for these type of orders that come through?
And will it do voice recognition so that you can order a new air conditioning system, but I can't?
Yeah, indeed. So interesting times that we live in. We're going to follow this one, this story with interest. It's something we've talked about quite a lot already. And this is the first news, of course, from CNBC that Amazon is getting ready to bring Alexa to work. Amazon haven't commented on the story at this point, it's worth saying. But if CNBC are reporting it, I think it's probably a good chance that we're going to see it in the very near future. So we'll draw a line under it there. That's what's been going on. Thank you for joining us, and we'll look forward to speaking to you in a couple of weeks' time.
You're listening to Frankly MSP.
I'll put links to the articles and resources Carl and Richard discussed in today's show notes at avic.com, A-U-V's and Victor, IK.com/FranklyMSP/008. Now we come to the interview with Nigel Moore, the man of 1,000 SOPs. That's right, Nigel estimates that before he exited his MSP, he and his team had documented close to 1,100 SOPs. We're going to talk about why he developed so much documentation for his business, exactly how he did it, and the many positive outcomes he saw from it. Let's listen. Hi, Nigel. Welcome to Frankly MSP.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. Topic we're going to talk about today is a very interesting one. It's SOPs or documentation. And you have an extremely interesting story about this area and how it's affected your MSP. So why don't you start by telling us a little bit of the journey that led you to your aha moment with SOPs?
Okay, cool. Let me take you right back to the beginning. I started working in the IT support industry in 2002, 2003, and worked for a business for a couple of years and ended up inheriting some clients from that business and starting my own MSP in 2008. And during that time, I tried building it in many different ways, and we hired staff and we fired staff and we lost staff. And we got good at some things and we got great at some things and we got bad at some things. And as we went through the growth process, one of the things I always tried to work on was our documentation and our checklists and our SOPs. And kind of got to this point where we were about 10 staff and we were doing okay. The business was working quite well, but a lot of it was revolving around me and my head, and I had to be involved in a lot of the decisions in it. And I kind of got to the point where I was working 60, 70, 80, dare I say it, some weeks was probably 90 hour weeks. And myself and my wife ended up having a baby on the way. And so we decided enough is enough, time to dig right in and start working on this documentation and really turning the business into a business and not just a high paying job, which is what we had at the time. And so we started the journey of trying to really implement documentation in our business. And we had about 50,000 failures along the way of trying to implement that. And we finally got to a point where it was working pretty well. And that was kind of a couple of years before I sold the business. We got it to the point where the team was engaged, people were following them, people were creating them, people were improving them all the time, and we were really starting to get really great at what we were doing. And so that's kind of my journey from the beginning to the end. When we sold the business, we had in our SOP system, we had about 1,000 or 1,100 entries in there. An entry could be anything from the way we quoted a monitor to how to receive a check from a client to how to tell a casual client that they don't have guaranteed response time. So there was all types of different SOPs in there that covered a lot of our business.
Wow, that's incredible. So starting out, it must have seemed pretty overwhelming to decide, okay, I'm going to document my business, but where the heck do I start?
It's the old elephant. How do you eat an elephant? Is one bite at a time. And that's kind of the thing that I see a lot throughout the community, the MSP community, is people look at documentation and they see it as this enormous, enormous problem and this enormous thing to attack. And it means that they don't start because there's all this overwhelm. And unfortunately, that means most people just keep their ideas and their concepts and their checklists and whatever in their heads. And so the way we started is our first SOP was the SOP for how to create an SOP. And that might sound very meta, but we wanted to keep some structure and formality to it just to make sure that everyone kind of stuck to the process and stuck to the way we did them. And then we kind of snowballed from there. And the way I first started doing it was, and the way I first started eating this crazy big elephant was I did a bit of a time audit of my own time. And I did that using a little tool called Toggle. And I just tracked all the different types of work that I work on for a couple of week period. And I looked at it and went, wowzers, I'm working 15 hours a week in sales admin and procurement. And that's ridiculous. I could be outsourcing that, or I could be hiring someone on the team to be doing that for $20 to $30 an hour, if not less. And so I worked my rear end off for the next 2 to 3 months, documenting and working in that particular area. And my wife was working in the business at that time, so she really helped in that area as well. And then I'd do another time audit again, and I'd figure out, okay, well, where's the rest of my time going? What am I spending the most time on? And that might've been accounting. So then I worked really hard at documenting how we manage our accounting. And we just went through that kind of process iteratively. It was kind of stair-stepping our way up to getting better and better and better as we went. But the whole thing was, it was a big, big elephant. We just had to take one little bite at a time. And my encouragement to people all the time is don't get overwhelmed when you look at the whole picture. Just start with 5 minutes a day, five, maybe 10 minutes a day of documentation. And every single person out there, you're lying to me if you can't find 5 minutes a day in your business to be able to just work on something. And what happens is that 5 minutes really compounds. If you've got a team with you and you all work 5 minutes every day at just adding a little bit here or improving a little bit over here, you can start to see some amazing kind of outcomes after a couple of months.
It sounds like, were you doing a lot of the documentation yourself in the beginning, or did you sort of farm it out amongst your team?
No, absolutely. In the beginning, I did a lot of it. I'm going to say out of those 1,100 in there, I probably did 25 to 30% of them. And in the initial stages, when we first got it up and running, I probably was doing 60 to 70% of it in maybe 3-4 years ago. And over time, I also got to the realization that, hey, if I'm the only person doing this, we're still not going to grow very fast and we're not going to go too well. And that was the kind of time when I was just documenting things and I was just saying to our team, okay, guys, you need to do it this way. You need to follow my way, my way, my way, my way. And that was one of my first big mistakes, in that people don't get engaged if they're not part of the solution. And so that at that point in time, I went, okay, well, I'm doing all this time documenting and creating all these things, and a couple of people are doing some things, but it's not working amazing and it's not working to the kind of level that we need it to work. And so at that point, I sat down with the team and said, guys, we've got a problem. Documentation process is not great. I'm trying. You guys are struggling a little bit. It's probably mostly my fault, but let's solve this problem as a team. Let's not me tell you exactly how to do it. You guys are better problem solvers than me. Let's solve this problem as a team. And so we sat down, we spent a couple of nights in the boardroom and the whiteboard out and structuring things on the whiteboard and whatnot. And we figured out how we wanted to structure this thing and how we wanted to implement it. And once I got past that step of involving the team in the problem, that's where it really, really picked up. The guys were involved in creating the solution to the problem, so they were really engaged at that point. And it was kind of my ego at the beginning, thinking I'm the only way that, like, I know best and I need to create these SOPs the way I want them. And I wasn't giving my team wings. I wasn't letting them fly. And it was a little bit hard for me to get through that kind of step to realize that my guys are all great problem solvers as well. That's what I hired them for. So let's solve it together and let me trust them to also come up with amazing answers to it. And they did. And I ended up getting over that whole ego thing where only I know best. And from there, it kind of spiraled into when we sold the business, it was quite a pretty good system at that point in time.
What was your approach to maintaining those and keeping them up to date?
So we had a pretty loose rule in our business. I've seen some businesses go extremely strict on this, but our loose rule was at any particular time, you should be either following an SOP, creating an SOP, or improving an SOP. And that was the kind of thing that we embedded in our culture. And the way we embedded it in our culture was we had to start off with a little bit of bribery. And the way we did that was right at the beginning, when we're just getting up and running with the process, we bought things like big chunks of movie tickets. And every time we'd see someone do a great job at improving a particular process or creating a particular process, we'd go and in front of everybody, we'd go and give them a couple of movie tickets and say, hey, you did a great job at that. Well done, kind of thing. And that was the kind of bribery, forcing it to try and be part of our culture. But that got people realizing that they can be part of it. And some people ask questions on that, like, do you trust your team to go and create your processes for how your business work? And right at the beginning, I probably didn't. And that was my fault, not their fault. But what I said after a while is, if I don't trust my team to be able to improve these processes and create these processes, then I've hired the wrong team. It's as simple as that. And when I let them fly and really jump in and create things on their own, and that's, as I said, that's when we started to really see some really great momentum.
It seemed like that would create a culture of you know, looking for those efficiencies, when you're thinking in a process sort of way, then you're always looking for a better way to do something.
Correct. Yeah, it's the old Kaizen theory from back in, I think that originated in Japan, was just continual incremental improvement. And that was something we always had in our business, was just continually incrementally improving, because no matter where you are in business, you can always get better. And if you've got that realization, if the team's enabled to be able to help your business get better, you can really go a long way.
Now, were you influenced very much by the E-Myth by Michael Gerber?
Right at the very beginning, that's where I knew that we had to go in and create these processes and whatnot to build the business as a system. However, the second book, the E-Myth was instrumental. That was kind of really instrumental in me understanding what has to happen to build this business as a business and not as a high-paid job. But the second book that really kicked me off on the journey was one called The Checklist Manifesto by Atul Gawande. And he's got some really good, I won't dive into the stories here because I know we've got limited time, but he's got some really, really good analogies and ways to figure out how deep to go in checklists, how checklists should be used and whatnot. And that kind of really kicked me off into that second phase of the journey, where I got the team involved and we tried to figure out what needed to be documented and what doesn't need to be documented and whatnot.
That's interesting. I've heard other MSPs mention that book. And I know that he is a doctor, and so he wrote a lot of his book with healthcare examples, but you found it very relevant for IT, did you?
Correct. Yeah. And he uses the medical story a lot as the foundation of that book. However, he also dives into a couple of other stories. And the one that really resonated with me was the one about the airplane and the war. And I won't dig into it here. It's if you want to find more, go and read the book or listen to the book. I actually listened to it on Audible, which was even easier. And it really resonated with me. And it's the story that I used with the team when I said, hey, guys, we've got a problem. We've kind of got to this point in the business where the technology and the processes and whatnot that we've got in there are too much for our little heads to comprehend. And for us to be able to take the step to the next level, we need to realize that we have to get this stuff out of our heads so that we can focus on the bigger and better things inside these processes. And I used that story of the aeroplane and the war, which go and read the book and you'll understand what I mean, as the kind of impetus to get the team on track.
Well, I'll definitely put links in the show notes to that and encourage our listeners to check that out. Sounds interesting. In terms of technology, what were you using to help support this process?
We didn't have the great tools that are available nowadays. So we kicked off using Confluence, which is a wiki. It's like Wikipedia. And we broke it down into a couple of different sections. We kind of broke our business down into the way that Gino Whitman does in a book called, I can't remember the name of it right now, but Gino Whitman's got this amazing book based on how to structure a business. Traction, that's the one. How to structure a business. And we broke our documentation system inside our wiki down into those three key areas, which is sales and marketing, service delivery, and finance and admin. We broke it down into those three areas inside our Confluence, and we just created some structures inside them. The service delivery one had a client area and had a help desk area and a checklist area and whatnot. And we just structured it that kind of way based on the system breakdown inside the Traction book from Gino Whitman.
Now, you mentioned that at some point you sold the business and the documentation really helped you sell the business. I want to get into that in a minute. But before that, when you were operating with this full set of SOPs, what were the differences you were seeing in your business?
I wasn't needed to be included in everything. And so when I was working 70, 80, 90 hour weeks, I was involved in every single part of the business. In the last couple of years, we moved house to 3 hours away from where the business existed. And that was good in one way, in that I could spend a bit of time working on the business remotely. But what it meant was that I didn't have to be involved in the day-to-day. And eventually it got to the point where my day-to-day responsibilities in the business, I could have done in 5 to 15 hours every week. And the rest of the time I typically worked either on the business or I also had another business that I was working on at the time as well. So it really, for me, it helped me extract myself from the business and turn it into a business, but it also helped our team get great at things. And that's what ultimately you want to do. You don't want to be okay. You don't want to be mediocre. You don't want to be average or good or whatever. You want to be great. And the only way to get great at things is to be able to get them out of your heads and onto paper so that you can continually improve them. And so they're the two key things for us, getting me extracted from the business to the degree I did, and getting our team being able to be really great and enabled to do really great things for clients.
And now tell us about that process of selling the business and the role that documentation played there.
The key thing it did for us was it meant that I didn't need to be involved too much after the business sale. And a lot of people have quite long 2-3 year kind of lockup periods when they do a sale. And I can't get into the specifics of ours because there's NDA, but ours was nothing like that. And because the whole business operated, the new owners were able to grab the business, buy it, or they purchase a business, and they were kind of able to just let it go from day one and see what works and how it works. And they kind of backdoored a lot of the processes that we had into their business because they were looking for some more procedures around certain things, and they kind of implemented a lot of what we had in our business into their business as well. And so it was kind of a more of a strategic sale than a financial sale, because these guys really wanted to get access to some of the stuff that we'd built and created and our team that we'd had running the thing for them. And so that really helped. And they've been able to take that team and those processes and those people and integrate it into their business and improve it even more so.
So that's interesting, not just buying a book of business, but buying the intellectual property. That's essentially what you had built there.
Correct. Yeah. And that's what I mean by a strategic sale versus a financial sale. Most people are buying a book of business, which only comes at a certain multiple. When you can have other value adds in there, such as an amazing team and a great SOP system, that can really increase the value of the deal.
If you wanted to have MSPs take away one important thing from our chat tonight, what would that be?
Don't be overwhelmed and realize that it's a continual incremental process, that if you start today and you commit to continually incrementally improving over time, you will get through the process, or you will never get through the process, but you will get to a much better place than you currently are now. And that's a guarantee. That's one thing that I can guarantee. You can't go through and document and improve all these systems for 3, 6, 12, 18, 24 months and not be in a better place than where you currently are now. So my biggest takeaway is just start. If you haven't started already, commit to continually working on it and realize that it's a big elephant, and that's okay, but realize that a big elephant can only be eaten by those small, tiny 5, 10, 15 minute chunks.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Nigel, for joining us tonight. I think that was both inspiring and practical.
No problems. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That was Nigel Moore of My Technology Company. Nigel mentioned a few books and tools during our interview, so I'll put links to all of those in the show notes today at avik.com/franklymsp/008. If you want to learn more about Nigel or his consulting business, I'll put that info in the show notes as well. He's got a great online peer group called the Tech Tribe that you should check out. Well, that's a wrap. Comments or questions on today's episode? Have you used SOPs in your business? Share your thoughts and ideas on today's show notes at avik.com/franklymsp/008. This is our last Frankly MSP episode for 2017, but we'll be back in your earbuds with episode 9 on January 11th. That's when I'll talk to Don Crawley, the compassionate geek, about how your techs can improve client satisfaction with some human-friendly skills. Till then, this is Jennifer Tribe. Thanks for listening.
Frankly MSP, brought to you by Avik Networks, the most efficient and profitable way to manage your clients' networks.